my shepherd, I lack nothing. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. He refreshes my soul. He guides me along the right paths for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the darkest valley, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil, my cup overflows. Surely your goodness and love will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever.
Hey, good morning. It's good to see you here this morning, and let me just take a second to welcome those of you who are in our overflow room. If you need anything in there are ushers in there. Hopefully you got a bulletin when you came in. Anything that you need, there's some folks in there that will take care of you. And I'd like to welcome those who are on Facebook Live joining us right now. We're glad that you're worshiping with us virtually and that you're a part of this as well. So this morning we are continuing our series in the book of Psalms, and we're looking at the psalm that you've likely heard many times before. Undoubtedly, Psalm 23 is the most famous of the Psalms. It's the most often quoted of the Psalms. It's one that you've heard likely at funerals before. It's one that I have read at gravesides many times after the funeral service has happened in the church or in the chapel, and we've gone to the graveside for those last few moments together. I will typically read Psalm 23 and then pray. It is one that is most often used during these times of loss, when people are grieving, when they need comfort. Why is that? It's because Psalm 23 is a very practical psalm. When you're hurting, when you're grieving, when you need some words of comfort, you're not really interested in a theological discussion about the nature of the Trinity. You know, you're not really trying to figure out how many angels can fit on the head of a pin, right? You want practical answers. What is it that God can do for me right now? And that's what Psalm 23 does. It is not this ivory tower, 30,000 foot, let's talk about all of these concepts about God. It is a ground level, real world, you're hurting, let's look at what God can do for you right now kind of psalm. And here's why. Most scholars agree that Psalm 23 was written by David, the second king over Israel, during or just after a very difficult time in his life. If you're familiar with the story of David, you may know that there was this point in his reign as king that his own son named Absalom decided to rebel against his father. Absalom said, "I want to become king now. Not willing to wait for dear old dad to die." And so Absalom mounted this army and he invaded Jerusalem, where David and his troops were gathered, and David inside the castle where they all hung out. Absalom invaded Jerusalem. Word got to David, and so David and his government and his army had to exit quickly out of Jerusalem. And just to give you a picture of how emotionally distraught David was during this time, there's this one episode where David and his government and his troops are going along this dusty road. They're trying to get away from Jerusalem, trying to get away from the armies of his son Absalom. And they're going along this road past a village, and there's this guy who comes out named Shimei the Benjamite. Meaning he was from the tribe of Benjamin. Shimei the Benjamite came out and he began to just curse King David. Just lob verbal grenade after verbal grenade at King David, just telling him how awful he was. And he is just berating King David. So they're going by and one of David's bodyguards hears this guy. Everybody heard this guy. This bodyguard hears this guy, Shimei the Benjamite, yelling all of these curses. And this bodyguard thinks, well, this is ridiculous. I'm not going to let this go on. You know, I'm the Secret Service here. I'm supposed to protect King David. This guy's doing all of this. I'm going to take care of it. But he goes to King David first to ask him if it would be okay if he went and handled the situation. Here's what we read. This is in 2 Samuel. says, then Abishai, son of Zeruiah, said to the king, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over and cut off his head. In other words, I'll take care of it. He won't yell curses anymore. I'll cut off his head. But the king said, what does this have to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah? If he is cursing because the Lord said to him, curse David, who can ask, why do you do this? David then said to Abishai and all his officials, my son, my own flesh and blood, is trying to kill me. How much more then this Benjamite? Leave him alone. Let him curse, for the Lord has told him to. It may be that the Lord will look upon my misery and restore to me his covenant blessing instead of his curse today. So again, get the picture. David is going along, hunched over, shoulders sagging, a completely deflated countenance. And this guy is yelling all of these curses, and his bodyguard comes up and says, hey, I will take care of this situation for you. I will handle this guy, and he will curse you no more. And David says, just let him be. What does it compare to my own flesh and blood trying to kill me? Yeah, this guy's cursing, but how does that compare to my son who is after my life? Just let him be. Perhaps the Lord has told him to do this. Just let him be. And maybe God will look upon my misery and he'll restore to me the way that life used to be. He will look down and he will protect me. He will help me. But just let the guy alone. I mean, this was a guy who was overcome with depression during this point in his life. Now, eventually, God heard his prayer. Eventually, David and his men were able to regroup. They turned. They faced the armies of Absalom. They were able to defeat the armies of Absalom. David was able to return to Jerusalem and to his castle and finish his reign there in Jerusalem. But at some point, either during this time or right after this time, David sat down and he penned these words that we now call Psalm 23. And in these words, we find this guy who was looking for God to come in and practically speak to his situation. God, tell me what to do. God, who can you be right now in my life? So this morning, we're going to go through this psalm verse by verse, and we're going to answer this question. Here's the question we're going to answer. What does God do for me? It's a question, really, that all of us want an answer to. If you're brand new to church, if you're just kind of checking all of this out and you're not really sure what you think or whether you've been following Christ for a long time, this is what we want to know. Especially when we're in pain, when we're hurting, when we're facing some struggle in life, we want to know, what is it that God does for me? I mean, you may say, you know, I know God created the world. I know that he is in heaven and surrounded by angels right now. I get it that God parted the Red Sea. I get it that God raised Jesus from the dead. But here's what I need to know right now. What is it that God does for me, especially in the midst of my pain and my hurting? So let's talk about that. This is on the back of your bulletin there. Number one, what does God do for me? God provides for me. Here's what David said, verse 1. The Lord is my shepherd. I lack nothing. God provides for me. The Lord is my shepherd, and I lack nothing. Now, if you've been in church for a while, you know the story of David. Before he was king over Israel, David was a shepherd. It's not your typical career path in the field, watching sheep, to ruling over a nation. That's not your normal career path, but that was David's path. And so here David remembers back to his days when he was a shepherd, when he would be out there in the field with the sheep, that the main part of his job was to lead the sheep from place to place so that they could find pastures where they were able to get food. As a shepherd, his job was to provide. So here David paints a picture and says, do you want to know what God is like? God is a shepherd, and we are sheep. And so God provides for us as the shepherd, and because God is providing for us, we lack nothing. Then in the next verse, he talks about how this happens. Verse 2, he says, he makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. He refreshes my soul. So again, the job of the shepherd was to lead sheep into green pastures, to make them rest, to make them lie down so that they would rest there, and to provide a place where they were able to get water, where they could have food, where they could have nourishment. And here David says the same about God. We are the sheep, God is the shepherd, and so God leads us to places where we can lie down. In fact, what he says, and I think this is interesting, is he makes me lie down. He doesn't just lead me to this place and say, okay, now if you want to rest, you can rest. There are times that as our good shepherd, God will say, you've been going too hard. You've been doing too much. And so I'm going to make you lie down for a while. If you've been around Northway for a while, you know that about 3 years ago, I was diagnosed with a spot that was melanoma. Fortunately, it had not gone below the surface of the skin. So in the cancer world, it was pretty good to have because all it required was surgery. That was the good news. The bad news was the spot was right on the end of my nose. And because of that, the doctor, and it was melanoma, and they have to get wide margins. Not to be too gross, he had to chop off the end of my nose. And I can't believe I paid him to do that, but that's what they did, you know. And so the cancer deal wasn't that big of a deal, but the reconstruction that the plastic surgeon had to do was a big deal. And I had a period of about 4 or 5 weeks that I looked like a character out of a horror movie. I mean, it was awful, and it was disfigured as they were doing the reconstruction. And in fact, it happened right during Halloween. And my kids begged me to answer the door the way that I looked and scare all the kids. And I would have. I just felt awful. Like, I just did not want to do that. And so for 4 or 5 weeks, I was basically just kind of down and out. I could work from home a little bit, but I didn't want to go outside and scare everyone. And so I was really just sidelined for a period of time. Now, it was not fun, and I definitely don't want to go through that again. But looking back on it now, here's what I know was happening in my life. I was going hard, going hard, going hard, boom, hit this cancer situation. I was down. I was forced to lie down for a while. Then, immediately after that, our church began a construction project that would consume the next year and a half of my life. And I think, looking back, that God was saying, I need you to slow down for a bit. I need to prepare you. I need you to rest for just a minute because of this next thing that I have for you. Now, I know what you're saying because I would agree with this 100%. You'd say, well, the verse says he makes me lie down in green pastures. A cancer diagnosis is not a green pasture. You know, having your face chopped up is not a green pasture. And I agree with that 100%. And like I said, I do not want to go through it again. The problem is we define green pastures differently than God defines green pastures. We define green pastures as financial success, being healthy. All of our relationships are good. God defines green pastures as working in and doing something in our lives and drawing us close to Him. And so there are times that God will make us lie down in green pastures in order to prepare us for something that He has to come. So God provides for us, one, here, by making us lie down, by giving us rest. The other thing is He guides me along the right paths for His name's sake. I've never been a shepherd before. I did not have that career before I became a pastor. But I did a lot of research about shepherding and learned some things I didn't know. And one of the things that I learned is that sheep are known as wanderers. They will just go down any path. They will go off without purpose, down some trail that they think is the right trail, into danger, away from water, away from food, into some place they shouldn't go. They are just constantly wandering around. And the job of the shepherd is to keep them from going down those paths. In fact, Charles Swindoll says this. He says, the Palestinian shepherd was a master at reading tracks. Many marks and paths sprawled along the rugged terrain. Some were made by wilderness beasts, others by robbers laying in wait. The wind also etched its subtle track in the sand. To the untrained, dull eye of the sheep, they all looked alike, like real paths, but they led nowhere. The sheep were wise to follow only their shepherd, who always led them along the right track. After all, it was the shepherd's reputation that was at stake for his name's sake. So here's what this verse teaches us. We desperately need to stay close to God. Otherwise, as sheep, we will go down the wrong path. And I know what you're saying. Wait a second. You know, hey, I'm smart. I know how to make the right decisions. Maybe you are. I mean, maybe you're super smart and you're successful and you've done all of these things and you've accomplished a lot and you've got the degrees and you're a really, really smart person. So let me just give you that. You're super smart. You're a lot smarter than me, okay? Here's what you don't know. When you're facing a decision, you do not know every factor, every variable from the past that has gone into that circumstance where you're trying to make a decision. You just can't. You do not know all the present circumstances, all the factors, all the variables, every little fact that is involved in that decision. And one thing that you definitely do not know is what the future holds. But we serve a good shepherd who does. And when we stay close to that shepherd, here's what the psalm promises us. He guides us down the right paths. And see, it's not just a smarts thing. If it was just a smarts thing, we might be okay most of the time. But there's this other issue that you and I have, and it's called a sin nature. And this sin nature will cause us to make really bad decisions, even though we know that it's going to take us to a bad place. We will still make those decisions. Why? Because we want it, right? Now, why did you do that? You knew that you would end up in this awful place. Yeah, I know, but I wanted it. I just wanted what I wanted. Years ago, when my oldest daughter, Elizabeth, was 3 years old, we were living in a neighborhood that is on the Cherry Blossom Trail. If you're from Macon, you know exactly what I'm talking about. It's this trail that goes down all these streets where these houses have cherry blossoms lining the road, cherry trees lining the roads. And every spring, you'll drive down, you'll see the beautiful white and pink flowers of the cherry blossoms as they are in bloom. And for about a week and a half, you'll have tour buses and cars just driving past your house, going down the Cherry Blossom Trail. Because we lived in one of those neighborhoods, we had all of this pressure from our neighbors to purchase one of these pink poodles. Not a real one, a wooden pink poodle that goes onto a metal stake, and it's got these metal brackets and attaches to the stake, and you put it in your yard during the Cherry Blossom Festival. I don't know why. I have no idea what a pink poodle has to do with a cherry blossom other than the color pink. I'm not sure, but that is, if you're not from Macon, you're like, man, that is weird. I agree. I know. It's strange. I don't get it. And don't send me the email explaining it to me. I just don't care. But we gave in to pressure. Okay, we didn't want to be the only neighbors without the pink poodle. So we purchased the pink poodle that you put in your yard with the metal stake, and you attach this wooden poodle with brackets. My daughter was 3 years old, and as I was going outside to hammer with a mallet this metal stake into the ground, she said, "Daddy, I want to go with you." "Okay, fine, you can come out with me." I began to hammer it into the ground, and she was at that stage of life where she wanted to do everything that I did. And so she says, "Daddy, I want to hammer it into the ground too." "No, you can't do that." "Why?" "Because you're 3 years old and you'll hurt yourself." "Daddy, I want to hammer it into the ground." "No, you can't do that." "Why?" "You're 3 years old and you'll hurt yourself." "Daddy, I want to do it. I want to do it. I want to do it." "Fine, I'll let you do it." Quit judging me. You've done the same thing with your teenager. Just drive the car. Take it. I don't care. Take the house. We're moving. You know, they wear you down. I mean, you just get to... Okay, you can do it. Now, honey, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to hold your hand as you take the mallet and you hammer this metal spike into the ground. Now, you got to be really careful. She says, 3 years old, I can do it myself. No, you can't. You can't. I promise you. I'm the dad. I know more than you. No, I can do it myself. No, you can't. She pulls away. Whack. What do you think happens? Oh, that thumb. That thumb was right on top. She, boom, hits that thumb. She begins to wail. She drops the mallet on the ground. She's screaming and crying and says, Daddy, why did you let me hammer that into the ground? I said, because you begged me. She said, honestly, she said, but I'm three. I don't know. You're right. It's not going to win me the Dad of the Year award. I get it. We are a lot more like three-year-olds than we really care to admit, right? We will do something, even when we know it's going to hurt us, we will do it because we just want to do it. You know, why are you buying that thing? You know you shouldn't buy it. You're going to max out your credit card. You're going to pay 18% interest over the next 10 years, so much more than you should spend on this thing. You know it's a foolish purchase. Why are you doing it? Because I want it. I just want it. Why are you taking that pill, that drink? You know where it's going to lead you. You know the path that you're going down. I just want it. Why are you texting him? Why are you going over to his house? You know where it's going to lead you. You've been there before. I just want it. We've all been there. We've all done that. I know this is dumb, but I just want to do it. This is why, listen, it is critically important that we stay close to the shepherd. When we wander away from the shepherd, we go down these bad paths. We've got to make sure that we stay close to God so that He can guide our decisions. Next thing He says here, well, the next thing that God does for me is this. Not only does God provide for me, but God also protects me. Look at verse 4. He says, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. For you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. This is likely the most well-known verse in the passage. Even if you're brand new to church, you've likely heard that phrase, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. Here's what David does, and I love this because it's so real. Number one is he very much recognizes that there are days that we go through valleys. You know, I know there are some churches and some pastors that teach that as long as you have enough faith, you know, you'll never get sick, you'll never be poor. You know, they teach that you'll always be healthy, which doesn't make sense to me. These people would live forever if that was true, right? I mean, if you had enough faith that you'd never get sick, then you'd never die, right? It doesn't make sense, but they teach that. The Bible teaches that, yes, there will be difficult days. There will be valleys. There'll be marriage problems and financial problems. And if you live long enough, all of us will have health problems and job problems and relationship problems. We'll all face valleys. And David here very much recognizes that we will go through valleys. But the other thing he does is he calls it the shadow of death. It's not the valley of death. It's the shadow of the valley of death. Meaning, if you are a follower of Christ, if you are under God's protection, if you are part of the family of God, then everything that you face in life is a shadow of something that can really hurt you. It's not the real thing. The shadow of a dog's mouth with teeth cannot bite your arm. It can look like it. It can appear like it's going to, but it cannot bite your arm. The shadow of a bullet cannot pierce your skin. The shadow of a bee cannot sting you. None of those things can actually, ultimately, and finally hurt you if you're a follower of Christ. I mean, your greatest enemy is physical death, right? And guess what? If you're a follower of Christ, the Bible's very clear. It's a shadow of death. It's not real death. Because at death, you become more alive than you've ever been before. That's what David is emphasizing here. That under God's protection, it's but a shadow of death. The other thing he says is, you are with me, your rod and your staff, they comfort me. Now again, this is shepherd language. Shepherds typically had a couple of tools they would use. One was a rod. It was something similar to a wooden baseball bat. And they would take that rod and they would strike wild animals that would try to attack the sheep. They would swing like a batter swinging at a fastball. I mean, just whack that wild animal to protect the sheep. The other tool they would have was a staff. And the staff would be lighter weight. It's wooden, but it's not as heavy as that rod. And the staff would be used to discipline and correct the sheep. So if they began to wander off in the wrong direction, the shepherd would take the staff and maybe kind of hook them and bring them back. If they didn't listen, he'd take that staff and whack them on the head a couple times and say, "Listen to me, sheep. You need to get back in place." And what David is saying here is God is our shepherd. What he does is he takes his rod and he fights our enemies, and he takes this lighter tool called his staff, and he disciplines us. He corrects us. If you're a parent, you get this. This is exactly what you do and would do with your kids. If someone came after my kids to cause them harm, to attack them, I would happily take a wooden baseball bat and I would swing at them to protect my kids. Absolutely. At the same time, if one of my kids did something wrong where they would hurt themselves especially, I'd take another piece of wood, not quite as heavy, you know, like a ruler or something like that. I would tap them with it, right, to correct them. Both of those actions come out of a heart of love that wants to protect my children from enemies that would hurt them and from them making decisions that would hurt them as well. That's the picture of God. That's how much God loves you, that He will fiercely fight your enemies, and at the same time, He will discipline you to get you going down the right path. The next thing he says here is, God protects me in this way. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. There's a lot of debate about that first word, you know, first phrase. Was David talking about a banquet table where God prepares this feast for him before his enemies? Maybe that was it, but more likely David was painting this picture of what God had done in this battle against Absalom. Potentially what had happened was David and his armies were running. They needed some kind of break. They needed some kind of help. And they came upon this plateau, a tabletop mound in the desert. And there God gave them the ability to gather, to turn against Absalom's army. And because they had higher ground, to defeat the armies of Absalom there. And so here, David could have been referring to that you have prepared this place in the desert in front of my enemies for me to be able to win this battle against them. Other thing he says is, you anoint my head with oil. So a shepherd would take this certain oil and he would put it on the head of sheep. Sheep are, according to what I read, very much bothered by flies and other flying pests. In fact, they get real agitated and they can't settle down with all these bugs around. So a shepherd would take the certain kind of oil that would repel bugs and would rub it on their head or on the bridge of their nose to keep those flies out of their eyes. And with that oil, the sheep was able to relax because the bugs were no longer bothering them. And so here David paints this picture of God anointing him with this oil to protect him from pests. Now, I've just got this feeling that I've got a bunch of essential oil people in here who are loving this right now. You're like, "Man, that is great. You mean that's oil, that's a bug repellent? You're trying to come up with these ideas." Let me tell you, just because I was curious, I actually Googled Psalm 23 essential oil bug repellent. Guess what? I couldn't find anything. If you're one of those essential oil people, I would mark this down, make some notes. You can market this stuff. You can sell it in these little bottles that have the King David, you know, Psalm 23 oil on it, and you'll make a ton of money, right? You're not writing. This is good stuff. You know, maybe somebody is, and you're like, "Yeah, finally getting something practical here. I'm going to make a lot of money off these essential oils." I mean, this is the picture that David paints, that God has anointed his head with oil to protect him. And the last thing he says is, my cup overflows. This very well could have been a reference to some kind of cup the shepherd would have had to get water to provide for the sheep, or it could have been a reference to his wine cup, that God allows his wine cup to overflow, meaning he is at rest, he is relaxing, he's having dinner, that God has provided this for him. So the shepherd provides, the shepherd protects. The third thing the good shepherd does is he pursues me. Now look at what David wrote in the last verse. Surely your goodness and love will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Here David does a couple of things. We'll start at the end. He says, number one, I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. David looks forward to this day where he will finally be able to relax, where he will finally be at peace from his enemies. Absalom will not be after him any longer. He will not be battling any other enemies. He will not have King Saul chasing him, the king who had pursued him for years. He will not be fighting these evil people called the Philistines. He will not be fighting this giant named Goliath, any other enemies. He will finally be at rest, able to relax, no more worries, no more concerns of life. He'll finally be able to relax. I think that's what all of us want, right? Even if you're not a believer in God, even if you're just kind of new to all of this and you're checking it out, I'd say, hey, do you want peace? Do you want contentment? Do you want, you know, this ability to relax? You say, yeah, absolutely. That's what I want. Here David looks forward to that day where he will be in the presence of God. And all the troubles will be gone. No more sickness, no more disease, no more enemies, no more battles, no more health problems, none of that. Finally be able to relax. The other thing that David does is he paints this incredible picture of God running after us with both goodness and mercy. A God who pursues us to give us these good things. In fact, Max Lucado, you've probably read some of his books before, said this: what a surprising way to describe God. We're accustomed to a God who remains in one place, a God who sits enthroned in the heavens and rules and ordains. David, however, envisions a mobile and active God. Dare we do the same? Dare we envision a God who follows us, who pursues us, who chases us, who tracks us down and wins us over, who follows us with goodness and mercy all the days of our lives? That is the incredible picture of God. He's not a God who sits back and says, if you're good enough, maybe you can come to me. Maybe if you work hard enough, you can come into my presence. Our good shepherd that we follow actually pursues us with goodness and mercy. Pastor John Piper actually uses a modern-day illustration to help us get a picture of what this is like. He says, imagine for just a minute that you're driving down the road in your car and you're going along, and suddenly you look in your rearview mirror and you see the blue lights flashing. And your heart sinks down into your stomach. You're like, oh no. And you look down and you're like, I'm not sure if I'm speeding. I didn't think I was speeding, but I'm not sure what the speed limit is here. Maybe I was speeding. And then you remember, oh no, I've gotten all of these tickets before. Like, this will not be my first ticket. And if I get one more ticket, I'm going to be in big trouble. In fact, I'm going to have to pay a huge fine if I get another ticket. And you remember that you have been saving up this money for you and your spouse to go on this cruise, a big anniversary cruise, and you've been putting money aside and putting it aside and putting it aside so you can go on this big trip together. And the thought goes through your mind, if I get one more ticket, I'm going to have this huge fine, and I'm going to have to take that money from the cruise account to pay this fine. Oh no. And for some reason, this irrational thought enters your mind, maybe I can outrun him. Maybe I can just run from this situation. And so instead of the brake, you hit the gas and you begin to go. And you're going, and the blue lights are behind you, and you're going, and you're thinking about all those tickets in the past, and blue light's still behind you, and you're going as fast as you can, and blue light's still behind you, and suddenly you begin to feel incredibly guilty. Not just over what you're doing and the fact that you're going to get caught and thrown under the jail for what you're doing here, but all your other past sins begin to enter into your mind. You're like, I am so awful. Look at all that I have done. And you just become overwhelmed with guilt. And finally you realize, I can't get away. This is ridiculous. And common sense takes over. And so you pull over to the side of the road and you're sitting there and your heart's just beating 100 miles an hour and your hands are shaking. And you look in the side view mirror and you see that car door open and the big state trooper gets out of the car and he puts on the hat and you think, here it comes, here it comes. He's going to arrest me. He's going to take me to jail. You know, I'm done for. There's no cruise. I mean, this is it. And he walks up to the window and taps on the window and you roll it down and he looks at you and says, got a guilty conscience, huh? He says, the reason I pulled you over is the hotel that you stayed at last night, you left your wallet there. And he pulls out a wallet and says, they asked me to return your wallet to you. And they told me to tell you that last night you registered for a drawing, and they had the drawing this morning, and you won, and it's a cruise for two. You need to call the hotel to accept this prize. Have a good day. And walks off. That's the picture that David paints in this psalm. A God who chases us with mercy does not give us what we deserve. We deserve to be arrested, punished, thrown in jail for our crimes. Who pursues us with mercy and goodness and gives us far more than we deserve. That is the good shepherd that we serve. That's the good shepherd who loves you so much and wants you today to follow him.